From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Amid an outcry from workers about coronavirus, the big three have shut down their auto plants for the foreseeable future.
All three companies felt they had to go down together. When they come back, I think we'll have more to do with their own assessment of the situation.
We'll take a look at the auto company's plans and whether they could retool to manufacture ventilators. The United States is in desperate need of more equipment to help people breathe.
You know, in the old days when they did this, they had a bag and someone would do it by hand. Now we have these machines. They are among the many miracles of modern medicine, but there is a limited supply of them.
Finally, we'll check in today with artists gigging online.
I just happen to have this wonderful crew. I happen to have this beautiful space and a lot of friends who are in this same boat with me that are all their gigs are canceled too.
Those conversations and much more coming up on today's episode of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later in the program, we're going to dig into the difficulty of manufacturing more ventilators in short order. But first, the big three automakers have wound down production amid worries about the spread of the novel coronavirus. Here to tell us how big this is Daniel House, business columnist with the Detroit News. Daniel, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
How long did it take the big three to come around?
There was a meeting on Sunday convened by the president of the United Auto Workers, Rory Gamble, actually a phone call, with the CEOs of the three auto companies and the relevant vice presidents on both sides of the table, in which the union laid out their concerns. They were getting a lot of pressure from below, from the floor, from local leaders. There was a grievance filed in Local 600, which is over in Dearborn, a big, old, and powerful local, saying this isn't right and our people shouldn't be made to work. Plus the fact is that the automakers had told their white-collar workforce, work remotely if you can, unless you're in some kind of critical work where you need to be in, say, an engineering studio or whatever the case may be. So they had that they had to contend with as well. The auto companies, particularly GM, I think, wanted to continue to operate, thought that they understood how to keep the plants clean. They'd been through this in China with their plants. They'd been through it in South Korea. They had a pretty good understanding of managing it, they thought. That was not, however, going to translate here in the United States, particularly when you started to get reports of individual workers testing positive for COVID-19.
Right.
As a result, I think people start getting kind of wigged out. You had a person at Jefferson North for FCA, downtown Detroit, who vomited, and nobody wanted to clean it up. Nobody wanted to get close to it. Now, vomiting is apparently not part of the symptoms of COVID-19, but
people are nervous.
People are nervous and jittery, and I think they were getting to a point where the UAW was not going to be able to, quote, control their people as they were contractually bound to do. And I think also you had, for example, at Ford, their new chief operating officer, Jim Farley, paid a visit yesterday morning to Dearborn Truck and talked with the workers. And he could sense the concern and that this was a problem. And I think as managers and executives, they kind of came to the conclusion, we have to listen to our people at the end of the day.
So is anybody talking about how long these closures will be in effect yet?
Yeah. I mean, in essence, it's about 2 weeks, about the end of the month. It depends a little bit, depending on the company. I think the general feeling was because of the way the relationship between the United Auto Workers and the three companies is, all three companies felt they had to go down together. Now, they may go down in a different fashion, but they'll ultimately get to the same place. When they come back, I think we'll have more to do with their own assessment of the situation. I think GM said that they would go down until about the 27th or the 30th, and then they would evaluate it on a week-to-week basis. So, I mean, I think it's entirely possible, depending on the state of play in Michigan and other states of the disease, that they could come back at the end of the month. They may be, you know, the first, second week of April. I think that all remains to be seen. But it's important for people to understand, for every week those plants are down, it has a major hit on the GDP of the state. Michigan makes more vehicles than any state in the country. So it has a knock-on effect that will compound the longer these plants are not operating. Because if plants are not producing vehicles, they're not selling vehicles to the dealer body, and revenue happens for an auto company when the product leaves the plant, not when it's bought by a consumer.
I don't know if there's anything in the union contract about epidemics, but will workers be compensated during this time?
Yes, under I think it's contractual language that in general terms means that people get unemployment and they get what's called SUB, which is an acronym for supplemental unemployment benefits under the contract.
Yeah. It feels like it wasn't really that long ago that Michigan's automakers were dealing with the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. How would you rate their fiscal health right now?
A lot better. Than it was. I wrote a piece about this earlier in the week, they can burn about, it's estimated by Morgan Stanley, they would burn about $4 to $5 billion a month, GM and Ford each, meaning they've got the cash and liquidity to operate in an environment where you have like 90% decline in revenue for 5 to 6 months. That sounds like a long time, but it's not necessarily. And they could get into distress, but not nearly as quickly, I don't think, as they did. And it's important to note for your listeners, Ford just this morning abandoned their guidance for 2020 and is moving to cut their dividend, mm-hmm. Eliminated actually, because they're trying to conserve cash. And I don't think that's going to be the first time you're going to see that happen. They're drawing down on their credit lines.
Has that happened since the recession? Is this the first time they've had to make a move like that?
I don't want to say first time, but they did a lot of that. I mean, certainly the way that Ford was able to avoid bankruptcy is that they had essentially mortgaged the business to the tune of $25-26 billion, including mortgaging the Blue Oval itself as a trademark. And they're doing that, some of that now. So if they've got, these companies have got credit facilities that they're able to draw on, it's just as if you had a credit line at the bank and you went and took down, you know, however much, $50,000, and put it in your savings account. So now you've now got the cash if you need it. And that's essentially what the Ford and other companies are doing.
Are any of the lessons that the automakers learned during that time applicable to what's going on right now?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's the real honest answer is I don't know. They need financial flexibility. They know that. They need to move quickly. They can't be in denial, which I think we saw in 2008 and 2000, or the run up to 2008 and 2009, which was, you know, things can't get that bad. We can't go bankrupt. People won't buy cars from bankrupt companies, which turned out not to be true, particularly if they got through bankruptcy really quickly, which is what happened with GM and Chrysler at the time. But I think reckoning with the world as it is, not as you want it to be, is one of the great lessons for the auto companies of 2008 and 2009. And I think that the people running these companies are much more realistic about the world than their forebears were, who tended to be products of the, if you want to say, the greatest generation, when Detroit kind of ruled the world. And, you know, those kind of things could never befall Detroit. Well, we now know that's not true. Yeah. And I think in the environment that we're in now, it's a very pitiless environment. You know, when you shut down an economy, the largest economy in the world, effectively, I mean, it's not totally shut down, but it has a major knock-on effect, as we see in the financial markets, which are trying to price in what the recession is, a recession is going to look like, how long it's going to last, how deep it's going to be. And that's why you've got a lot of confusion at this point.
When the automakers had their moment of cardiac arrest more than a decade ago with the recession, Michigan was hit very mm-hmm. hard. Mm-hmm. Since then, Governors Granholm, Snyder, and now Whitmer have stressed the need to diversify the state's economy so that everything does not hang on the health of car makers. Do you think we've been successful enough on that front in the intervening years to have less concern this time?
Yine, as they say in Germany. I would say this. Yes, they have, and I'd have to subdivide those governors. Some have been more intent on diversification than others. Jennifer Granholm focused a lot more on that. And really her 8 years in office were coincident to the so-called lost decade, largely because the auto companies were finally coming to terms with the fact that they had way too much capacity. It was sucking down way too much money. So they were closing plants and cutting jobs and over a very long period of time. And that happened to coincide with when she was governor. Yes, we've had some diversification. Yes, you've got a much more vibrant economy, I think, that's not just automotive. And the auto companies employ a heck of a lot fewer people, particularly in their plants. I mean, it's only about 150,000 between GM, Ford, and FCA in the United States, which is a fraction of what it was just 10 years ago. So, but the government has also really reinvested in the industry, and the industry has reinvested in Michigan. Your listeners know that there's been a lot. I mean, FCA's done it in Detroit. GM is doing it in Detroit. Ford is investing in Corktown and in the train station, and they're investing in their home. So that means that what happens, they are more concentrated here than they've been in a very, very long time. So whatever happens to the industry, we're going to feel it here. Michigan makes more vehicles than any other state in the union.
Daniel, what's all this I hear about automakers possibly retooling idled factories to make ventilators? Is that actually feasible?
That's a great question. I've got one of our colleagues working on a story on that. And I, in fact, right before I came on the air with you, I was reading a story in the New York Times about ventilators and how hard it is to ramp up production. These are complex medical machines that can keep people alive if they get into a very extreme situation with this virus. I thought it was when I heard this yesterday, Larry Kudlow, the president's economic advisor, mentioned this, I think it was on Fox News, and that he had talked with two CEOs of the auto companies and that they were looking at this. I was like, wow. So the first thing I think of is Arsenal of Democracy, right?
Yeah, of course.
How the auto companies retooled and
to make battleships and tanks.
Yes, and tanks and planes and trucks. And all three of these companies, if you look at their history, each one of them played a role in World War II in the so-called Arsenal of Democracy. If these companies know how to do anything, it's to manufacture at scale. Now, whether this actually happens or not, I think remains to be seen. I also saw a headline today that GE Healthcare is ramping up. They're a provider of this. But the question is how quickly, given the speed with which this is running, how quickly they can make a difference in any way, shape, or form. But I do think the leadership of both GM and Ford, for sure, would be very disposed to looking at this and would trying to do their part if, in fact, there is a way they can find a way to do their part.
Daniel House is a columnist and associate business editor at the Detroit News. Daniel, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The bans on public gatherings in Michigan due to the coronavirus outbreak has hit many, many sectors hard. We're feeling for performers of all kinds, including musicians. With bars and concert venues shuttered, some artists are getting creative about reaching fans from an appropriate social distance.
Even if you're quarantined in your homes, so are we. We're here in our basement playing music tonight. So glad to be so grateful. Grateful we can connect with you in this way.
This is Erin Zindel. Her band, Erin Zindel and the Ragbirds, is exploring what online music can mean beyond Spotify. They've launched a series of concerts called Live from the Birdhouse. Erin's with us now, and so is Elle Lively. She's the executive director of the Michigan Music Alliance. The group has created a Michigan Artist Relief Fund to try to help musicians get through the next few weeks and months. Erin Zindel, you had your first live streamed concert last weekend. How'd it go?
It was really great. I was amazed at the response. We had my friend Peter Madcat Ruth in my basement, and I have this really amazing team of audio and video engineers, and we were able to put it together so quickly and get the word out so fast, and people tuned in, and I just got so much really, really wonderful feedback from people that I could tell that it really meant a lot to them, and there was just such an awesome chat, you know, during the live stream. People were really commenting and chatting, and
so you could tell they were there with you.
I felt really connected. It was really special.
I can only imagine what it's like as a working artist to hear that announcement coming out of the state capitol that restaurants and bars are going to have to close. I mean, what brought you to the point of thinking, I need to get on this, I need to try to figure out a way for people to hear music right now?
Well, I started getting calls. It was just one morning. It was last Wednesday. We were having band rehearsal, and the calls were just starting to come in, and all the cancellations were starting to pour in. The shows that weekend were canceled. And at first, there was a moment where I felt just despair. It just was like piling on, and it was settling in little by little that this is a very serious problem. This is all of my income for the next who knows how long is just vanished. And I didn't let myself stay in that place of despair for very long because I could see and sense immediately that it was the path to illness. It's that I was starting to feel exactly the way that's going to make me more susceptible to becoming ill myself if I just am despairing. And I just set my mind to focusing on a solution. You know, I just happen to have this wonderful crew. I happen to have this beautiful space and a lot of friends who are in this same boat with me that are all their gigs are canceled too. And I just started making calls and just doing the work to line up the events. And I ended up lining up, you know, for the first day was that Saturday. It was just a few days after.
Wow.
I heard this news. I lined up Peter Madcap Ruth to play, and then my band played on Sunday, and then my brother's band played on Monday, and I've got artists for the next week. I've got artists every day in my home coming in to perform so that we can keep the music flowing. That's the most important thing. We can't let the music stop.
Elle Lively, what was the reaction when you started telling people that you were going to put together a relief fund to try to help working artists right now?
It was overwhelming right off the bat. We started working on this project on Friday when I realized what was happening and that everything was about to really change for our music community. And on Monday, Local Spins, John Sickvitz, was a huge help and helped us announce the fund. And since then, it's gotten really great traction, not just from the music community, but people who have friends who are musicians and artists and people who understand what is happening in that community right now. And so far, we've raised a lot of money. People have been really supportive, and they're also buying the merchandise that supports and goes towards the fund. So it's been a really positive response from artists and the general public so far.
Erin, how does doing a concert in a streamed format compare with being up on stage in a live venue?
It's a fascinating experiment, actually. You know, you don't get the applause between songs. We don't have a studio audience here. It's just, you know, when I'm on stage performing, the time that I was performing, I could just really, you really have to tune into the larger feeling of the audience out there. You have to know that they're there. You know, we didn't have it set up where I could even see their comments. So it felt, you know, a bit isolated, but that's what we're all experiencing. And you just have to know, you have to just remind yourself that people are out there, that they're listening. And later I was able to actually check the chat and tune into what people were saying and connect in that way and could see them actually saying words to me. But during the performance, you know, it's strange to finish a song and then have just silence or just a few people kind of clapping, just my crew. But
yeah,
you just kind of get used to that, and just it all, I think everything feels more vivid right now, as because of this crisis, we're really appreciating things in a different way, and you know the messages of the songs feel more real. Like they just everything feels more important, and so I was just kind of plugging into that to get the energy that I needed to power through the show and to make the music as powerful as I could deliver it.
Right. You know, Elle, the thing that I keep thinking about is there are some acts who are basically bedroom producers, and they're really accustomed to playing to small audiences or maybe even no audiences if they've just, you know, self-produced and self-recorded. And there are some artists like Aaron, you know, who can really, you know, can bring soulfulness and a lot, you know, just because that's kind of the space that their heads normally work in. But man, there's some acts that are such a live thing. They feed off the audience. They feed off the energy of being on stage. You know, hardcore shows. I mean, I just don't even know if that's going to be a thing during the quarantine. Do you think this has the danger to knock out certain kinds of bands?
I feel like some who aren't able to adapt as quickly as the music industry is will definitely have a harder time. My hope is that everyone finds their own niche in the live streaming world and figures it out. If your Facebook looks anything like mine right now, there are hundreds of artists, you know, figuring it out right now and figuring out Patreon and a bunch of different live streaming tools. For the bands that do work off of a crowd almost exclusively and are super high energy, I think we're definitely going to see different kinds of live streaming formats pop up where people can be more involved. But I'm still curious to see what happens. I don't have the answer for that. And my heart goes out to them because I know that is part of the joy of performing, is being able to connect with the audience face to face. And it's hard to replace that feeling.
For sure. Well, that's a great point about the technology, too. Aaron, what exactly do you need to host a streamed show?
Well, you can do it as simply as just holding up your phone, and a lot of people are doing it that way. We have an extremely equipped situation here in my home, which is why I'm offering the space for other performers to do it here, because what we're able to present looks and sounds completely professional. We have a multi-camera live feed. We have a multi-mixed audio that with Mark Allen, who's one of the best sound men in Michigan. I think he's the best, but No offense to my other sound men friends. But anyways, he's amazing, and he's able to like to just produce this. It sounds so polished and professional. And so we're kind of taking it at that level. There's just so many different ways to present this, and you're seeing that as artists are doing these live streams. There's a huge array of quality, you know, difference and the level that they're taking it at. And I'm really grateful. We just happen to have been already practicing this very thing. We've already been working on gearing up and working out the bugs of our live streaming, because we've been live streaming the Ragbirds performances lately. And So we were ready to do this. We had all the gear, and it just so happens we're able to do this at a higher quality level, which is much more complex than what most people are doing.
Aaron, I ask this knowing that musicians are unfailingly the first whenever there's a big disaster or, you know, something weather-related going on. Musicians are always the ones, you know, who are right out front organizing benefits and giving of their time and their talent. But are people going to be able to pay to do the kinds of things that they need to do, like using somebody's studio facility for live streams and stuff like that?
Well, I don't know. You mean like artists paying to use other people's spaces for? I haven't seen that situation really come up. I think artists are streaming on their own, and like, you know, I'm not charging people to use my space. I want them to come and play, and we're asking the listeners who are enjoying the concerts to contribute to the artists. So I've also established an ongoing fund for the artists that are playing here mostly for the artists just in my community, within my circle of friends who are all out of work, including the crew, the sound people too. And I've been collecting money, and people have been very generous, and I hope that they will continue to be, because it's one thing to start off with that novelty of like giving on the first couple of days and excitement in the beginning, but we may need a sustained support for who knows how long. So yeah, we're going to need people to be you know, aware that they, maybe for the first time and in a brand new way, that they value live music enough to support it now and to keep it happening. Because otherwise, you know, we're going to lose it.
Yeah. Elle, it's not just musicians, really, who are feeling the ripple effect right now, too. There's so many other kinds of people who work behind the scenes in performance. Your company, the music company, the music management company that you head up, Crooked Tree Creates, is out there. I just heard from a friend who works for a music licensing company that he's been furloughed. Can you talk a little bit about the ripple effects beyond artists and sound engineers themselves?
Absolutely. You know, there are so many jobs in the music industry that people don't even think about when you think live music performance. There are, on a larger scale, there are wardrobe people, there are motor people, there are light people. I mean, there are so many huge productions traveling around the country right now who are out of work. And then on a local level, too. My company, we have 20 artists that we represent, 5 agents plus myself. And that's how I knew something was happening, was all of a sudden all 20 artists had canceled gigs out for now 2 months.
Wow.
And then on top of that, my 5 agents have no income because that was based off of the gigs and they already put in the work to make those happen. So it's definitely impacting educators in a way too, you know, people who teach piano out of their home or drums or bass, they're not able to have people in their home at this time. So they're also switching to virtual lessons when they can. But the sound engineers and everyone who works behind the scenes, they're also feeling it and they can't go on and perform on a live stream. So they're having to figure it out on the fly. I also work at Third Coast Recording Studio in Grand Haven, Michigan here. And thankfully, we have enough projects right now where we are able to close the doors to the public and buckle down with what we have and almost play some catch up and get things rolling and bring people in one at a time. But it definitely has slowed down. No one's walking through the door on a daily basis now.
I wonder if this could be the thing that brings back durable brick and mortar sales of music, which has just completely evaporated from the income streams of artists ever since the digital music revolution took over.
I totally agree with you there, because if you want to support an artist that you love who is struggling right now, the best way to do that is to go online and buy their t-shirt, buy their record. And also a lot of artists are coming up with Patreon accounts who really haven't explored that path before. And Patreon is basically a subscription service where you get to be a super fan and get special benefits. And it's a really neat way to get more engaged with the artist. So there are a lot more things where I think we're going back to basics, you know, and I think that can be a good thing.
So. Yeah. Erin, I've realized as we're doing this interview that amidst everything else that's going on, you're a mom.
And you yes. I'm a single mom with my child now out of school, and I have her now 24/7 every day. And it feels like I have 2 brand new careers. Now I suddenly have a new business, and I'm the booking agent and the promoter of this new business. And also I'm a full-time educator and full-time caretaker for my 6-year-old. So yes, this is absolutely nonstop every minute of my day since this all has happened. I've been working at an incredible pace just to keep up, and it's so important. I've been telling her that I need to, like, that this is so important that you know, when times are troubling, when people are in need, that they need this positive message, that they need the music. And this is my calling right now, and I'm asking, you know, when I have to ask her, like, to be patient with mama. Mama's really busy right now. Can you just, you know, stay busy doing your game for a minute? Because I gotta get this done, because people need the music right now. And she understands that, and she gets to witness that firsthand. This is a really critical experience that she's going through right now, that we all are, but that she gets to see it from this little perspective, you know. It's pretty amazing to witness.
Well, ladies, we're going to post some links to the things that you're doing online, and I just can't thank you enough for staying active through all this. It's really astonishing. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Elle Lively is the executive director of the Michigan Music Alliance. The Alliance is planning a virtual music festival for later this month. It's called Spread the Music. Erin Zindel is the band leader for Erin Zindel and the Ragbirds. She's hosting a series of concerts called Live from the Birdhouse. You can find more information about all of this at our website, michiganradio.org. Also, you'll find a Spotify playlist of Michigan artists, something to keep your ears occupied while you're at home.
You are made of light and salt. Everything you do is all your fault.
It might feel as though it's been 1,000 years already, but Michigan is only 4 days into the coronavirus lockdown. Kids are home from school, public gatherings are banned, and you can't take the edge off at your favorite bar. That's closed too. We want to hear about how this is going for you. What's it like juggling childcare and working from home? Have you found ways to connect with loved ones in the era of social distancing? Maybe come up with some creative solutions to keep from going stir crazy? Tell us about them. Call and leave us a voicemail at 734-764-7840. That's 734-764-7840. You can also send us an email, stateside@michiganradio.org, or hit us up on Twitter. We're at Stateside Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. All of Michigan's hospitals are taking a careful inventory right now of their breathing apparatus. Ventilators will be essential equipment for stabilizing patients critically ill with the new coronavirus. Leaders like New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo have said publicly they are desperate to find more. Michigan-based writer Jonathan Cohn covers healthcare for HuffPost, and he published a fascinating story recently on where ventilators come from and what's going to have to happen if we want more of them. Jonathan Cohn, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You know, ventilators have become such a hot topic, but many of us don't really understand exactly what they do or how they work. Can you explain why they're so important right now?
Sure. So the coronavirus, it's a respiratory illness, right? And if it gets serious, you get to the hospital, you're going to have trouble breathing. And of course, lots of things can give you problems breathing and lots of illnesses. And in addition, often, you know, if you need surgery or you're undergoing some kind of medication, you might need assistance breathing because your pulmonary function, your ability of your lungs to breathe on their own might not be adequate. So a ventilator is a machine that basically pushes air down a tube into your lungs and then pulls it back out. It basically mechanically breathes for you. And, you know, in the old days when they did this, they had a bag and someone would do it by hand. Now we have these machines. They've gotten progressively more sophisticated. And of course, they're complex. They're complex machines because you want to, monitor the oxygen going in, the rate of breathing, et cetera. So we have these machines. They are among the many miracles of modern medicine. But there is a limited supply of them.
Yeah, and it's safe to say hospitals keep them around for any number of reasons. But when you have an epidemic of an infectious respiratory disease, this is not something you can afford to be without. Can you explain who you spoke with and how you got them to talk to you?
Yeah, so there was a lot of talk early, as you know, I'd been doing some research on this talking to public health experts, I kept hearing the same thing is, you know, we're worried about the capacity of the healthcare system to deal with this. Do we have enough ICU beds? Do we, you know, and then people said, do we have enough ventilators? We need more ventilators. And so I thought, well, that makes a lot of sense. How do you make more ventilators? And, you know, public health people don't know that because that's not a healthcare system question. That's a manufacturing, you know, question. It's
right.
An industrial question. So I turn to people who know about those issues, people in manufacturing, in the medical device industry, people who understand the supply chain. Actually, one of them is a Michigan-based veteran of the device industry named Mark Van Sumeren, who was one of the first people I reached out to. And I said, hey, can you explain to me how these things get made and transported? Because, you know, we're going to need more of them. And lots of people are saying we need to ramp up production. Is that possible? What would it take to do that? And what should the government be doing?
What was his immediate reaction? I mean, was he sort of exhausted by thinking this through already at that point?
Well, you know, everybody is thinking about this already. And the sort of short answer was, well, they're already ramping up production and they expect to do more. But as with any complex machine, there's a bunch of different steps along the way. So you have to kind of walk through and say, all right, what can you do at each step? And if you're trying to think, how quickly can we do this? You really have to zero in on whichever step is the hardest, right? Because that's going to be the limit. You know, what is the hardest part of this process to fix? And what do you do about that? And then you kind of move through the chain and say, all right, and what do you do at each step to expedite things? And it's complicated. I mean, these machines are complicated. The process of building them is complicated. The shipping, I mean, every step of the way has its challenges.
Are there domestic makers of ventilator machines?
There are companies. It is a global enterprise. So you have companies headquartered all over the world. Some of them here, General Electric makes ventilators. And there are many companies that assemble them here. They have actual factories that churn out ventilators, although there's an asterisk to that. And people familiar with the car industry will can guess what it is, which is that even if you assemble the ventilators here, a lot of the component parts are coming from overseas.
What is the pace of work at the makers and assembly plants that produce ventilators? I mean, how many under normal circumstances would they be able to push out?
In the manufacturing world, it is a more medium to short assembly line process. You know, they can churn out the sort of worldwide output every year is the number I have, and I was told it was around 50,000 normally, so you can kind of divide that up. Obviously, they are right now working, you know, they've sort of pushed themselves to capacity. Usually, the factories work at about 80% capacity in the medical device industry. Pretty much everyone's at 100% capacity already because, of course, the entire world wants ventilators, right? Germany wants ventilators. South Korea wants ventilators. Everyone is looking to buy ventilators, and it is a global market. So already everyone's sort of at the max or approaching it. And some have already, you know, gone over their normal capacity. They're adding shifts. They're doing more. So they're already working pretty hard.
Can they get the parts that they need right now? I mean, it looks like the entire Asian manufacturing supply chain has been seriously disrupted, and we're just starting to see some places in China come back online.
Yeah, so this is when I talked to people in the industry, they said the thing that's going to hold this up, if you really want to ramp up production, the limiting factor is going to be the parts. As you said, they come from all over the world. You know, we're talking everything from, you know, specially made plastic casings to circuit boards. And a lot of these are not that hard to get. But of course, again, it doesn't matter if 95% of the parts are easy to get. If that 5%, if you're having to struggle with that, well, that you know, you need all the parts.
It's just the one widget, yeah.
It's the one widget, but you need that widget. And, you know, obviously, the normal circumstances, you can't just, as one engineer put it to me, you can't just walk out to Home Depot and get a different kind of screw or a different kind of circuit board or whatever. I mean, these are custom-made parts for the ventilators being produced. So there are supply chain issues. It's not clear how bad they are. A lot of that, I was told, there was a decent size inventory from a lot of the suppliers that they've managed to lean on so far, but they do expect that things are going to tighten up and it's going to be hard to get parts. And so if you're thinking about, you know, the analogy everybody has is, can we do like we did in World War II, where we were churning out the ships, you know, in weeks and then days? And, you know, if you sort of think about ramping up that quickly, well, at some point you're going to exhaust the supply of parts to put these things together.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jonathan Cohn. He writes about healthcare and health policy for HuffPost. So, yeah, when we hear someone like Elon Musk say that they would like to refit, that he'd like to refit Tesla factories to make ventilators, I mean, do you think that that could actually realistically be done in a fashion that would be fast enough to help with the domestic need right now?
So everybody I talked to was fairly skeptical of that kind of solution. Their feeling was, you know, the way to ramp up production is to have the companies that are already doing that know how to do this, just do more. And, you know, and you have them, you know, they're good at this, right? They have the machines. You know, you have to, if you think about the process, right, you have to get the parts, you have to put it together, you have to train the workers. You know, these are medical devices, so we want to inspect them pretty carefully, right? I mean, you know, you're not going to tolerate a very high failure rate. So presumably the easiest way to do this is to have the companies already doing it, you know, add to their capacity somehow. Now, within that, you know, maybe they can go to different suppliers. Maybe they can do some innovations. Now, look, I mean, who's to say somebody couldn't come in and try something brand new? I don't know. I mean, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures. I mean, there's this story running around, I believe is confirmed, from Italy, where, you know, they ran out of valves for some kind of breathing mechanism. I don't know, actually know if it was a ventilator or not, but some local business with a 3D printer came in and basically made 100 of them, as I understand it. And so, you know, you imagine solutions like that. There's a paper, academic paper running around where somebody, you know, actually anticipated a disaster scenario. What do you do if you need more ventilators? And you can, with, I guess, a little tinkering, make one work for three or four people, at least on a temporary basis.
Well, Jonathan, the question about 3D printing has come up in a lot of different kinds of journalism, from people saying, why aren't we doing this, to people saying, I tried it and I got arrested for it. I mean, is that something that the device makers consider feasible, that they would counsel people who have a machine to replace parts in that way? I mean, is that even safe?
You know, I wouldn't think so. I mean, and that gets to the problem, right? Which is that, you know, making 3D parts to do something on your car or some home, you know, appliance, great. You know, what's the worst that happens? You don't want to be messing around with ventilators. You know, this is life or death for people. Obviously, you know, if you get to the point where there's 10,000 people who need ventilators and you're a few thousand short, you know, who knows what you would try. You know, I do think the feeling is there are ways to ramp up production significantly in a reasonably short amount of time, by which I mean months. And obviously, months is too long if the surge hits right now. But, you know, they can get more production.
What might smooth the path for that?
So, I mean, there's a bunch of different steps. The federal government really does have an important role to play here. I mean, they can guarantee the purchase, that they can go to the company and say, look, we are going to buy, you know, X thousand ventilators, you know, just we'll buy them. And then, you know, we'll make sure they're going to get to the places that need them. You know, yeah, if you're going to add a factory, you know, every factory has to get, you know, regulating, you know, the FDA has to come in and make sure it's clean and it's doing the process right. Normally that can take 180 days, but the FDA can, you know, we can fast track these things. The FDA can come in and do it as, you know, super quick. You know, there may be transportation issues, you know, in part because of the economic slowdown. Cargo flights from Asia, I'm told, have really dwindled. So, you know, the federal government can come in and either hire those planes that are idling, or, you know, it's got the Air Force and military air transport and, you know, ship goods that way if it needs to. So, I mean, these are all steps that the government can take. And it's hard to figure out if the government is doing any of this or not. You know, you listen to the White House press briefing yesterday, and they, you know, the president and Mike Pence, vice president, you know, they were saying, well, we're on this, we're dealing with this. But everything I'm hearing is that actually the federal government has not taken that kind of initiative yet, which is a little disturbing. We're well into this crisis. Now, this is something you would have wanted to have happened a month ago or 2 months ago, when you could anticipate it. And so, you know, every day that goes by is a delay, and, you know, it's just going to get harder to fill that need.
One of the things that really surprised me in reading the article was realizing how many older ventilators are out there. How much help could we expect to get from older ventilator models? Are there any concerns about whether they can and should be used?
Yeah, so this is one of the big mystery factors. And I should say, one of the stranger things, although it's not strange when you think about it. You know, when I started this article, my first question was obviously, well, how many ventilators do we have? It seems like a very basic question. And turns out nobody is really sure. It's not like there's some central national registry of ventilators. We may make one now, and maybe a year from now we'll have one. We don't have one yet. So these are all estimates. And there are estimates running around, one from the Society of Critical Care Medicine, which, you know, represents intensive care doctors and nurses and other people who work in that setting. You know, they have an estimate that as many as 100,000 older ventilators are out there scattered in hospitals and warehouses, which would basically double the capacity we have now, or more than double even. Now, these are older machines. You know, how well do they work? That's not clear, but presumably most of them work. They are obviously less sophisticated than the machines we have now. I don't know that that matters. I mean, you know, again, especially, you know, it's not your ideal solution, but if they work, they should be good enough for this, most of them. I think a bigger concern for people was, will it take a lot of training to learn how to use them? Are they different? They break down. Do the parts still exist? But again, those are, You know, these are all things you would worry about if you were going to permanently say, well, let's just use these. But in an emergency, as a makeshift solution, yeah, I mean, that's potentially a very useful resource and maybe something that could really save us.
Have you seen, there's a Michigan physician who has put a video online explaining how you can sort of extend the usefulness of a ventilator by hooking up multiple patients to one machine. Have you seen this?
So I have not seen that video. I did read a paper on that. I do know this is an idea circulating. And again, I think this falls into the category of things you would not do under normal circumstances, but these are not normal circumstances.
Right.
If we are short on ventilators, are we going to look at things like that? You bet we will.
Becomes sort of a question of combat medicine and what we need to do to get through things.
Yeah, you know, people, I've seen the analogy, like, you know, people think the show MASH and how they were, you know, always improvising. Well, you know, we may end up there.
Right. So how are you feeling right now?
Oh, you know, I'm holding up okay. I think like a lot of people, you know, there's the adjustments to daily life with everybody being home. I have kids. I usually work at home, so I've done this before, but you know, even so, it feels different, these sort of social isolation. I know I have family I worry about. I have parents. My parents are both elderly. They live in Florida. One of them is in a nursing home, which, as you know, is a place of great vulnerability to this. So, you know, that's weighing on my mind. I'm either lucky or unlucky that my work lets me focus on these issues. So on the one hand, I can feel like, okay, if you know, this is a way to be productive, to be helpful by finding information and sharing it. On the other hand, I really can't disconnect from it because it's my job.
Right.
So, you know, it's got that plus and minus going for it. But, you know, like everyone else, you know, it's the new normal for a little while at least, and I'm getting used to it.
Jonathan Cohn, thank you so much for the article, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Jonathan Cohn covers healthcare and health policy for HuffPost. A lot of you may have heard Lester Graham's story on Michigan radio a little earlier this week about Ann Arbor Distilling. The tasting rooms closed, along with all Michigan's other bars and restaurants. So what to do with the downtime? As Lester told us, the team decided to shift operations from gin and vodka to producing hand sanitizer, which they were handing out in small bottles for free. We got a nice note from the distillery this week saying that listeners to Michigan Radio came from as far away as Flint and Lansing to pick up some hand sani. The distillery says many either bought some liquor as well or donated to the U.S. Bartenders Guild Michigan Chapter Relief Fund. You can still stop by today or tomorrow between noon and 6 p.m., so says tasting room manager Danielle Barrage.
We are open for selling bottles and then for people just to come in and grab the hand sanitizer.
The hand sanitizer is free while supplies last, or if you want to take over your own small bottle, they'll fill it up for you. We understand the plan is to crank out another batch of sanitizer next week. Now, don't get me wrong, this is beautiful, but I kind of hope they save enough alcohol for the product, too. My main source of helpful vitamin C right now is coming from fresh squeezed Greyhounds. Good for what ails you. That's it for today's show. Tomorrow on Stateside, if you're feeling like this has been a bit of a week, you are not alone. We're going to speak with Michigan's Teacher of the Year about her new job, homeschooling her sons, plus how students in her district are feeling.
They're confused and they're sad, and I think the novelty of being home from school is going to start wearing out pretty soon.
Listen up for her tips on tomorrow's show. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening, and stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow.